It's called presidential harassment.
I want nothing.
And it's unfortunate.
I want no quid pro quo.
This should never, ever happen to another president, ever.
I don't know. I haven't spoken to Rudy. I spoke to him yesterday briefly. He's a very good attorney, and he has been my attorney. Yeah, sure.
Shut up, Rudy. You don't know what you're talking about.
What they've done to General Flynn.
Russia, Russia, Russia.
What they've done to others.
It was all bull.
This is Josh Barrow, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers, the podcast about all of President Trump's legal issues. And Ken White is with me. Ken is my co-host, a criminal defense attorney and former federal prosecutor. He blogs at popehat.com. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Josh.
So on Monday, acting Department of Homeland Security head Chad Wolf appeared on Fox News' Tucker Carlson Tonight, and Tucker asked why the heads of Antifa and Black Lives Matter hadn't been charged under, for example, the Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act for what Mr. Carlson alleged was their responsibility for riots in various cities, including Kenosha, Wisconsin. Wolf replied that that was something the Justice Department was looking into. So, Ken, is this RICO?
It is not RICO. In his defense, it's kind of polite to nod politely when crazy people are talking to you. And, you know, he's on Tucker's show and he's got to pretend that Tucker's not completely crazy, even if he's being completely crazy. Here's why it's not RICO, Josh. Even if there is this shadowy organization that is orchestrating these various riots, then that doesn't make RICO the right tool to go after it. As we've talked about many times on this show, RICO is extremely overcomplicated to use for the vast majority of crimes out there. If you have people traveling in interstate commerce to commit crimes, there's all sorts of simpler, more straightforward statutes. There's plain vanilla federal conspiracy statutes. You don't need to go to RICO. RICO here, as usual, is being used as an exclamation point to say, gosh, this sure is serious and we're taking it seriously. It's not RICO.
But so when Chad Wolf said we're looking into that, he pointed to that they had arrested a substantial number of people who had been involved in various activities in Portland and elsewhere for various federal crimes. And then he said that they were investigating the heads of these organizations. So if it's not RICO, is there some other federal law that the Trump administration could be using to pursue or harass the heads of various organizations that, I mean, you know, it's hard to ascribe responsibility for a riot, right? You have these political protests that have gone on around much of the country. In certain cases, they have devolved into illegal activity by certain people. Is there a role for the federal government to have there where it's actually investigating not just individuals who engage in rioting, but some sort of organization?
You know, here's the thing. The charges you see from the U.S. Attorney's Office in Portland, Oregon, are a variety of fairly run-of-the-mill federal statutes. They didn't need RICO to do it. And if you had proof that someone was directing people to commit those crimes or sending them in interstate commerce to go commit those crimes or aiding and abetting them, then there are federal statutes for that. You simply don't need RICO, which is an extremely overcomplicated way to describe the vast majority of crimes. If they had the evidence, they could do it with the simplest federal statute there is, the 371 conspiracy statute. And if they had the evidence, they'd do it.
Is Antifa an organization within the definition that would apply for RICO or for any other crimes or any other federal statutes in which you might pursue an organization? I mean, to the extent it exists, it is a loosely organized, non-hierarchical collective of self-identified anti-fascists. It's not incorporated, but I suppose a drug cartel is not incorporated either. So what does organization mean within the context of these laws?
Well, it's a good question. I don't think Antifa is an organization any more than, say, MAGA is an organization. It's a slogan or, basically a saying. And are there some groups of people who self-identify as Antifa who have a structure and an organization and leaders? Probably. And you could go after those particular people based on the particular things that they did. But you can't just treat everybody who uses the same slogan as part of the same organization any more than, say, the Tea Party was a single organization as opposed to groups of people with similar aims and views.
this idea that the unrest around the country doesn't just consist of individual crimes, but of organized activity that the federal government should be pursuing in an organized manner, was also being pressed by Senator Rand Paul, who on Thursday of last week, after President Trump's acceptance speech from the White House lawn, where he claimed the Republican nomination, the senator and his wife were surrounded and accosted by protesters as they tried to return to their hotel. And the senator says he wants a federal investigation into this. He wants the FBI to look into where these protesters came from and who, if anyone, paid for them to come to Washington, D.C. This is what he said on Fox News.
I promise you that at least some of the members and the people who attacked us were not from D.C. They flew here in a plane. They've all got fresh new clothes, and they were paid to be here. It is a crime to do that, and it needs to be traced. The FBI needs to investigate, but the only way you can do it is you have to arrest people. And usually we say, oh, well, you didn't get hurt, so we're not going to arrest them. They were inciting a riot, and they would have killed us had the police not been there.
So having looked at these videos, I am confused about what crime Rand Paul thinks he is proposing was committed here. In the videos, it looks like the protesters are blocking Paul's way and chanting slogans. In one instance, a police officer jostles the senator and sort of the chaos. What crime could someone be charged with here? I don't see how any of this could constitute incitement to riot.
No, incitement to riot would have to be urging people in a way that is intended and likely to cause imminent lawless action. It's not just shouting things. Similarly, it's not assault or battery unless they actually touched Rand Paul or unless they did something that put him in reasonable imminent fear of being attacked. Now, I think being surrounded by a screaming crowd is probably extremely intimidating, but the screaming crowd does have First Amendment rights. That includes saying nasty things to politicians. And to me, it's very difficult looking at the video to see a crime, let alone a federal crime. And this just kind of goes to show that conservative is a libertarian who's been spoken to impolitely. Paul does not seem to be living up to his supposed background as someone who favors limited government and a limited controlled criminal justice system here.
There was another incident last week where some Black Lives Matter protesters in Washington, D.C. were going up to patrons dining outside at a restaurant and demanding that they raise their fists in solidarity. And there was a woman who refused, and the protesters became fairly aggressive with her. And you said on Twitter that you thought that that possibly was assault, what the protesters had done there. So where is the legal line here? What sort of screaming at someone actually can be a crime? Because none of the protesters touched that woman.
Well, it appeared to me there that one of the protesters, and these appear to be, you know, white college kids, got very close to the woman sitting down and moved in a way that appeared that she was going to strike her. If that's the case, that could be assault, because assault is putting someone in reasonable fear of imminent unwanted touching. And if Rand Paul has any argument, that would probably be his best one, that something that the people surrounding him did put him in reasonable fear of imminent touching that was unwelcome.
And so then going back to Paul's claim, for which I don't think he has a lot of evidence, that this was an organized activity in the sense that there was some outside person funding and directing the behavior of these protesters, it seems like, I mean, if the ultimate crime in these cases is an assault that did not involve any actual physical touching, it would be sort of weird to charge a conspiracy to engage in that, right? I mean, like whether as a matter of, you know, of prosecutorial resources or that sort of thing, like, you know, it's the sort of the crime itself probably would not be charged and tried, I assume, the sort of, you know, assault that doesn't actually involve a battery. And so it seems like it would be even less plausible to try some sort of conspiracy to engage in that crime.
Yes, it's unlikely that this type of thing would be charged. However, an assault or battery on a senator based on their role as a senator would be a federal crime, and you could conceivably charge somebody with conspiracy to do so or with aiding or abetting it. But realistically, I think what's going on here and in a lot of the talk about RICO and other ways to go after Black Lives Matter or Antifa as groups is an effort to delegitimize everybody who's associated with those names or slogans. It's a way to dirty up anyone who's marching or protesting and treat everyone part of an illegitimate criminal organization position such that even the people who are marching, protesting peacefully are somehow discredited.
I mean, wouldn't the other thing be that if we're trying to balance a couple of concerns, you know, one is the right of people to protest and to raise their grievances to others, and the right is and the other is the right of people to have some sort of quiet enjoyment and not to feel intimidated by other people in public, not to have reasonable fears that they are about to be attacked. It seems like that balance is different when the question is about an ordinary citizen dining at a restaurant versus a powerful public official leaving a political rally. It seems like the First Amendment interest in screaming at Rand Paul is significantly stronger than the First Amendment interest in screaming at this diner at a restaurant.
True. And let's point out that Rand Paul had a police escort with him and that the protest was proximate to a protest of a White House event. So certainly there are probably more pronounced First Amendment interests there and more of an argument that he was not genuinely threatened. I would have to say, although I think that Rand Paul's description of this is vastly overblown, that if I were in his shoes and being surrounded by screaming people, I probably would have been intimidated. And I think most of us would have. But that's not necessarily the test, whether you're intimidated by protesters. Assault requires something considerably more.
Speaking of shady organizations, another former deputy finance chair of the Republican National Committee may soon be indicted. According to the Washington Post, businessman Elliot Broidy, who was one of Michael Cohen's few clients — Michael Cohen put together a hush agreement for him a few years ago. Anyway, Broidy is expected to be charged in an investigation related to claims he engaged in unregistered lobbying for the Trump administration to drop an investigation into Malaysian government corruption and also to extradite a Chinese dissident back to China. So, Ken, first of all, the Justice Department doesn't go tell the press that it is thinking about charging someone. Do you have a sense of how this story would have gotten into the Washington Post?
Yes, absolutely. It got into the Post because someone who's clearly a cooperator entered a plea agreement. So someone who's lower down in the hierarchy of this thing, a woman who was connected to Broidy, entered a guilty plea pre-indictment and a cooperation agreement. And the statement of facts in her case refers to the people she was assisting as person A or person B, but it's pretty clear who those people are. And it's the vanguard to those people being charged. So that's how everybody figured it out.
So this presumably would be another Foreign Agents Registration Act case where, like, you can engage in lobbying for all the shady figures you want, but you have to tell the government you're doing it. And Elliot Broidy didn't and claims that he was never a lobbyist for these people.
Right. And the government's had mixed success with those arguments in recent years, as we've seen, but they are getting more aggressive with them. And this would seem to be, based on the descriptions, a prime example.
So I know you note that we had this guilty plea on Monday, and we've known about this case for some time. There have been previous news stories about this investigation, so you might infer that they're getting close to Broidy. But I was wondering if it might be that people from Broidy's side would be talking to the paper about the likelihood that he might be charged soon. And the story says that they've been having talks about a plea. So it's not like it's going to be some big surprise to Elliot Broidy if a charge comes down against him. Might they be hoping that Bill Barr or Donald Trump would intervene to stop yet another one of the president's former associates being charged for a crime by Trump's own Justice Department?
Well, Josh, in a normal year, I would say that's a bizarre, paranoid, and ridiculous speculation. But this is 2020, and it is the Barr Justice Department and the Trump administration, and I would say it's not outside the realm of possibility. I think even with this set of people, it's a bit of a long shot, but you might decide that's a long shot worth taking, given how devastating federal charges are.
The criminal information from that alleged co-conspirator who pleaded guilty, Nikki Davis, it says that she helped coordinate an $8 million retainer fee to Elliot Broidy for his efforts related to getting the Trump administration to drop that Malaysian case, and that the agreement also promised him a $75 million success fee if he managed to get the investigation stopped. So I just want to note, that is a lot of money. That makes you an extraordinarily well-paid lobbyist.
Well, I mean, if you're going to sell out your country in order to help a foreign government bring people back to torture them and drop investigations, then you should be well paid. Josh, if you're good at something, make sure you get paid for it.
Although it's not clear to me that he was good at it. I mean, the investigation didn't go away. Joe Low, this Malaysian businessman who is said to have presided over this fraud, basically sort of running off with this money from a Malaysian government investment fund, he had to pay a civil forfeiture settlement last year of $700 million to the United States. So I tend to assume you've had a bad outcome if you're paying a $700 million settlement, although I don't know what his exposure could have been. But it at least doesn't appear to be the case that Elliot Broidy successfully went to the president and was like, hey, drop this matter, and then they did.
Yeah, but we're talking about the era of Michael Cohen and Rudy Giuliani. So what does success look like really now in 2020?
Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk about Michael Flynn. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers. This is Josh Barrow, and I'm back with attorney Ken White on All the President's Lawyers. If you listen to Left, Right, and Center, you've probably heard a fair bit of conversation about the failure of lawmakers in Washington to reach a deal on another coronavirus relief package. The last package was passed in March, and the enhanced unemployment benefits that were in that package expired at the end of July. But the Trump administration, in absence of a new congressionally passed package, has been looking for ways to use executive action to provide relief. Ken, I want to talk with you about the legality of one of those actions. This week, the administration has announced an order from the Centers for Disease Control that purports to bar the eviction of residential tenants who make less than $100,000 a year on the grounds that such evictions risk exacerbating the spread of coronavirus. This is under some sort of quarantine authority. Does the CDC really have the authority to make a national proclamation like that?
Yeah, that's highly questionable. The CDC's authority derives from the Director of Health and Human Services Authority. It's been delegated to them on this. And there is a federal law with federal regulations that say that they can take measures to prevent the spread of diseases. And that includes things like inspection, fumigation, disinfection, sanitation, prevention of travel in some cases, things they deem reasonably necessary to prevent spread of a disease. This seems like a pretty big jump from fumigation to prohibiting eviction across the country. Most commentators seem to doubt that this is within the scope of the statutory and regulatory authority of the CDC. It may be perhaps primarily a political move to make it look like they're doing something.
When the Trump administration used a sort of similarly questionable strategy to use FEMA disaster relief money to extend some amount of enhanced unemployment benefits, one thing that people were saying about that was that it really wasn't clear that that was legal, but it was also not clear who would go to court to object, that the parties that conceivably had standing and could say they were harmed by the extension of further unemployment benefits were unlikely to actually sue. I assume that's not the case here. You will get landlords who have a clear harm from this order, who will not have a political reason to hold off on suing in the way that, you know, House Democrats were unlikely to want to sue to stop the president from extending unemployment benefits without their authorization. So it's the courts probably will actually get a crack at this, right?
Oh yeah, undoubtedly. I mean, the block on eviction would potentially cost some landlords a lot of money. There are organizations that represent landlords, and it would be pretty straightforward for one of them to go to court and sue over this and challenge the authority to do it. They're going to seem sort of like the bad guys to a lot of people who are in desperate economic circumstances here, but they'll do it.
Let's talk about Michael Flynn. We talked recently about the oral argument where 10 judges of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals reconsidered that three-judge panel order that would have forced long-suffering federal Judge Emmett Sullivan to promptly grant the government's motion to dismiss the charge to which Flynn had already pleaded guilty. The whole circuit reversed that decision by a vote of 8-2, saying they would not yet order Sullivan to do anything in particular, so Sullivan now gets to consider the arguments about what he should do with that motion to dismiss. What was the court's reasoning here?
The court's reasoning, the majority, was that this is premature and it's not something that needs the extraordinary emergency relief of a writ of mandate. Basically, they said that he hasn't ruled yet. If he rules and you don't like the way he rules, you have various remedies. But right now, we're not going to go out of our way to tell a judge how to rule on a pending motion that he hasn't ruled on yet. It's Josh, I thought it was interesting that the attorney who was arguing for Judge Sullivan signaled that it was likely that Judge Sullivan would ultimately grant the motion and dismiss the case, which is what, you know, we've been saying we think is likely to happen for some time. And the panel in ruling cited that. It seems to me that Sullivan is signaling and the circuit is signaling that they understand that this is really a way for Sullivan to talk about the issues and explore what's really happening here before ultimately yielding to the executive authority.
So what should we expect to happen next? Flynn has the option to appeal to the Supreme Court. You'd been saying that you didn't think the court was likely to take that case up. So what should we expect in Sullivan's courtroom?
Well, I do think they'll try to go to the Supreme Court. I think it's more likely the Supreme Court will refuse to hear anything about it because it's really more about the procedural issue of whether a writ is appropriate than the substantive issue. Coming back to Sullivan, I think he will hold hearings, ask tough questions, rake the government over the coals, but ultimately he will grant the motion, taking a lot of parting shots at the government on the way out.
And do you think that'll happen before the election?
Yes, I imagine that Sullivan will contrive to have that happen and that he's waited long enough and he wants it to happen. Also, Josh, I just noticed and I wanted to state my appreciation for the fact that the term long-suffering federal judge is no longer one person. It's more like a title that travels, like James Bond or the Batman.
Yes,
yes. So let's talk about Don McGahn, because there was another important decision at the D.C. Circuit in the past few days about McGahn. This is the case about the former White House counsel, whether he would have to comply with a subpoena from the House of Representatives. And the court basically said that the House of Representatives doesn't have any power to enforce a subpoena through the courts, and so they can't enforce this one. That seems like it's a pretty sweeping decision, right?
Yes. Recall that first the issue with the McGahn case was that the panel originally said that Congress didn't have standing, the right to bring a suit, and then a en banc panel overruled that. And then you have the panel back again. Now they're saying that, well, you can't enforce this subpoena, House of Representatives, because you don't have any law that lets you do so. And you can't just imply or infer a right to do it from the language of the Constitution. So back in the 70s, after the whole Watergate affair, there was some development in the law in Congress about who could compel what. And there was actually a law passed that expressly allows the Senate to go to court to enforce subpoenas, but there was not an identical law passed for the House of Representatives. And what the majority of the panel here says is, sorry, you know, you're trying to do something that you don't have a specific statute allowing you to do. You can go back and pass such a statute and use it, but for now, you don't have any specific statutory authority. The judge in dissent argues that you have to infer that authority from the structure of the Constitution and from just the fact of giving Congress subpoena power in the first place.
And so what is that going to go en banc again? This is this like some improbable luck thing here? There are 7 Democratic-appointed judges on the D.C. Circuit. There are only 4 Republican-appointed judges. And yet a number of these important cases, we've been getting these 3-judge panels that have 2 Republican appointees, which would not seem to be very likely. In this case, as in some of the prior ones, it is the 2 Republican appointees who voted in the favorable direction for the Trump administration here. And so again, you can go again and again en banc to get the short Democratic majority, but it's remarkable to me how that keeps happening.
Well, I mean, that's the way circuit courts work, and that's why appointing judges to the federal circuits is such a major priority for the Republican Party, less so in the past for the Democrats. And yeah, it does make a huge difference who you draw, no matter what case it is. Yes, I do think this will go en banc again. I'm not as confident in a different result this time as I was the first time through, where I thought the standing argument was pretty clearly wrong. But I think it happens again, and I think it ultimately goes all the way to the Supreme Court.
How could the House have standing to sue to enforce a subpoena if it has no legal authority to enforce a subpoena?
Well, that's an excellent question. It also raises the question, if they didn't have legal authority, why didn't that come up earlier. So standing and legal authority are a little different. Standing is about whether or not you've been injured in some way and whether or not the federal court is a suitable place to deal with the injury. Specific statutory authority is a little more specific and complicated.
But wait, sorry. Isn't the question of whether the federal court is an appropriate place to seek remedy for the injury, isn't an element of that there's actually a law that allows the court to do so?
Yeah, there is. And to me, that's why this decision is questionable and why the earlier panel decision that there was standing implies that there's statutory authority. That's a good argument. And I think that this outcome is somewhat bizarre.
Finally, let's talk about the Vance case. District Attorney Cyrus Vance in Manhattan, who has been pursuing the president's financial records from his accountant. So there was to review the past for this case, the president made arguments that he was immune from this investigation because he was president. That went all the way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said, no, you are not immune. However, you have all of the remedies that are available to a regular person to object to subpoenas. And so he made various objections in the trial court. The judge rejected all of them. And then there's an appeal to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, and there is a stay that court issued on those subpoenas while it considers the question of whether it should overturn that district judge's decision that the subpoena to Trump's accountant could proceed. And so they're going to do this pretty quickly, right? The district attorney has said, well, I'm going to wait for the court to rule on this. How long is it going to take the appeals court to decide whether these subpoenas can finally be enforced?
Well, the Court of Appeals did set a very accelerated briefing schedule. It's going to be heard the end of this month, the end of September, and there could be a decision then in October. But bear in mind that whatever happens here, it doesn't result in the public getting information about Trump's tax returns anytime soon, because this is a question of whether or not the grand jury gets these things. There's actually speculation that Vance already has some of these documents, the tax returns, and that the reason he's seeking these particular set of documents is to head off at the pass anticipated defenses that the Trump organization might raise. Like, you know, we did this because the accountant said it was okay. Well, you would want the accountant documents to show that's not true. But whatever happens, it now looks as if you'll have a decision on this the second round through sometime in October. But that doesn't mean that the Trump tax returns become public before the election.
Yeah, that's the kind of funny thing about the district attorney trying so hard to get the president's tax records from a third party, his accountant that would have them, right? I mean, New York State levies personal income taxes, corporate income taxes. Your federal tax returns and generally get filed as an exhibit to your state tax returns. So New York State already has these documents, presumably, and what you're saying here is it's likely that the district attorney has already been able to obtain those internally from within another arm of the government. The question is just what you're laying out here. All these, you'd have draft tax returns and communications between the accountant and the client. And I assume there's no accountant-client privilege there, right? It's not your tax attorney's advice to you would be privileged, but your accountant's advice, the government can obtain that as part of an investigation, right?
That's right. And just to be clear, it's the blog Just Security and a writer named Martin Scheil who is suggesting that maybe Vance has this stuff already. But I think it's a colorable theory. No, you don't have a accountant privilege. However, it's not unusual for defendants to make an aggressive attorney-client privilege argument. They keep the attorney in the loop of discussions with the accountant and argue that the accountant is being consulted for purposes of getting legal advice. That's actually what's one of the issues is in that New York Attorney General motion to enforce subpoenas that we talked about last week, an aggressive attorney-client privilege argument that's trying to hold back accounting records on the grounds that they're being used to assist attorneys.
So if that theory is correct and the attempt to obtain records from Mazars, the accountant, is not about learning the information about what was in Trump's taxes, but about but about rebutting a potential defense in a criminal case about those taxes. Does that provide us reason to suspect that this investigation is farther along than we have previously talked about it being? I mean, we've talked about how the tremendous breadth of the things that the district attorney has suggested that he might be looking into, and how it was completely unclear whether this was an advanced investigation or whether they were just looking into some interesting things that were in the New York Times without knowing for sure whether they'd be able to bring any sort of criminal charges or not. Is this a reason to think that they're actually farther along than we thought?
Not necessarily. I mean, having the tax returns doesn't mean the investigation is particularly far along. And we don't know. And given that it's a grand jury investigation, we shouldn't know. I mean, the last few years, we've seen a whole lot of speculation about investigations that ultimately has not gone anywhere. And so it's a good thing to be cautious and circumspect in speculating about how close to an actual indictment something is. So it could be advanced enough to be close to charges, but it could be just really fishing, or at least in very preliminary stages.
There is much more for us to talk about, but I think that's a good place to leave it. Ken White, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Josh.
If you have questions about the president's lawyers and his legal issues, please send them to us. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW. You can also leave us voicemail at 424-538-8888. All the President's Lawyers is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director today is Kat Yore. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and Ken and I will be back next week with more All the President's Lawyers.